Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the New Books in Literary Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Britt Edelin, your host, and today I'm joined by my guest, Danielle Herskovits. I knew I was going to do it. Hello, Daniel. Welcome.
Hello. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
So today we are going to be talking about your new book, Heidegger and His Jewish Reception, which was published by Cambridge University Press. It was a great book. And previous listeners of my podcast, or at least the ones that I've done, know that Heidegger is a very important thinker, and I do a lot of work with him. So this was a really interesting book for me, but I think you juggle so many different topics, and it's a applicable book to a lot of different studies, and I'm sure we'll think about that. But before we get into talking about the book, I want to give your little introduction. So, you are a career research fellow in Jewish studies at Wolfson College, the University of Oxford. Prior to this, you were, the Stanley A. and Barbara B. Rabin postdoctoral research fellow at the Department of Religion, at Columbia University. And your research interests include modern theological and philosophical exchanges between Judaism and Christianity, as well as on secularization, nationalism, technology, and translation. And these are all topics that are coming out in this book, and I hope that we can talk about a few of them, at least in our conversation. But before we do, I'm going to start out with my first question, which is, can you give us a little introduction to yourself, as well as how you came to writing this book?
Yes, well, thank you for the introduction. Well, I have always been very interested in questions of philosophy and religion and their intersection, mainly Judaism and Christianity, mainly of the modern period, but not only. And well, just the things that I was interested in repeatedly led me to this philosopher, Martin Heidegger, who is, as you said, a very important philosopher, but also a very controversial one. And he's controversial for many different reasons, but perhaps the main reason that he's such a contested figure is that he was a member of the Nazi Party for 12 years, from 1933 till 1945. And there's a sense in which the entire reception of his philosophy afterwards is colored by this political affiliation. And there's just a tremendous amount of work written on his Nazism, the relationship between his Nazism and his philosophy. And that actually was not the topic that was most interesting to me. So when I was constantly led to Heidegger, and when I would approach Heidegger and think of what, you know, a Jewish reception of Heidegger would look like, what constantly I discovered in my readings is that it would be a great mistake to think about Heidegger's reception, Heidegger's Jewish reception, only through the very minimal and limited lens of his political affiliation and his Nazism and the question of his anti-Semitism. So that basically led me to think, what if I look at this question of Heidegger's philosophy, Heidegger's Jewish reception, not from the perspective of what Heidegger might have thought about Jews, the question of his anti-Semitism, the question of his Nazism, but rather from the other side, as it were, and what Jews or Jewish thinkers thought of Heidegger and his philosophy. And this really just opened up this huge world, an endless amount of texts and perspectives and thinkers that could have been addressed under this, general topic of interest. But that's what ultimately led me to writing this book. The thought that Heidegger is this fascinating thinker his thought could be taken to many different directions. And if you want to approach his thinking through the religious perspective, what that might look like if the religion you take is the Jewish perspective. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think that's a really interesting introduction. I've studied Heidegger a lot and in a lot of different contexts. And one of the things people always ask me about when I say that Heidegger is, one of the most important thinkers to me is it's always the question of the Nazi or the Nazism, right, or the anti-Semitism. It's something that can't be discounted, but I always talk about how, on the one hand, you can't get around Heidegger if you are doing philosophy, or if you study philosophy in the 20th century. You just have to deal with him in some way. But on the other hand, it's, while the Nazism is not something you can discount, I think it's always more interesting to engage with him rather than just say, he was a Nazi, we shouldn't read him. There are much more interesting critiques, and I think we'll get into those, especially with Levinas, who was a student of his, who takes him up and then kind of does away with him or goes past him or transcends him in some way. But I wanna get a little, maybe a bit of a, to use a Heideggerian term, a grounding in Heidegger first. So he studied theology. I think he wrote his thesis on psychologism and in Neo-Thomism and Neo-Kantianism, and on Duns Scotus. So he has a huge background in theological thinking, but his main project is doing away with ontotheology and Christianity and the idea of God as positing or cementing being. Can you say a little bit more about Heidegger's relationship to Christianity and how we might have to think about it in relation to secularization or the secularization of Heidegger and how you're going into that conversation here?
Well, one of the things that I discovered while making the research for this book was that, could you hear me? Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I discovered while researching for this book is that the Jewish reception of Heidegger is intimately linked to Heidegger's relationship with Christianity. And an important part of the Jewish reception of Heidegger, the way they approached his philosophy and the way they responded to it, was related to elements and layers of Christian thought that was identified in his philosophy. And therefore, the question of Heidegger's relationship with Christianity is an important one. Heidegger, as you mentioned, was trained in Christian theology. He was born in a Catholic home, which is important and somewhat unusual in the tradition of German philosophy. And later on, he converted to Protestantism and then ultimately left Christianity as a whole. But he was well aware of the fact that his Christian, you know, in Heidegger's terminology, his Christian facticity, his upbringing in Christian faith really colored his thought and informed it and conditioned it in ways that were very difficult for him to just shake off. And I mean, this is relatively well known now that the years throughout the 1920s, right, his great book, Sein und Zeit, Being in Time, was published in 1927. And throughout the 20s, as he was developing the ideas that would later be formulated in Being in Time, he was reading Christian texts very intensely and developing his ideas through readings of Augustine, Luther, Kierkegaard, Paul, etc. And you could really identify a development of these ideas, how he finds them or begins to develop them in the early 20s as he's engaging these Christian texts. And then you could see them in a non-Christian context, formulized as this ontological analysis of human existence, of Dasein, in Being in Time. But at all times, Heidegger would insist that, and rightly so, that he is not doing theology at all, and that, in fact, what he's trying to do, he's trying to offer a fundamental ontology that may ground, Christian accounts of human existence, but does not presuppose any Christian assumptions, and is rather detached from the entire realm of theology. So Heidegger would say, I am doing philosophy, and if Christian theology wants to use the categories of human existence that I am offering in order to understand the ontic example of Christian existence, then by all means. But what I am offering here in my philosophy is not informed and not conditioned, and should not be read as such by Christianity. And as his thought continues to develop, he becomes very critical of Christianity and of Christian theology, as he takes it to be wedded to metaphysics and basically something that needs to be destructed, and entire manner of thinking that needs to be engaged in a very critical way in order for a new, different manner of thinking to become possible. So Heidegger's relationship with Christianity, on the one hand, Christianity is always there, not only because he grew up in a Christian context and was informed by its categories, but because it looms in the background as the constant framework that he tries to overcome.
That's a really great way of explaining it. And it makes me think of, so Derrida, in his conversation or his engagement with Heidegger on entitled his Geschlecht series, he talks about how Heidegger tries to neutralize or neuter Dasein and make it asexual or sexless or de-sexed, and so that it's this neutral, it's able to be universal, but it doesn't take in the particularities, which Heidegger would call ontic, rather than ontological characteristics of like modern identities. And I think something that you're bringing out in this is that Heidegger also maybe makes an attempt to neuterize or neutralize the Christianity of his thinking. And I think what's also interesting is that when I think of Heidegger, I immediately think of the Greeks, who were obviously not Christians. They were pagan in a certain sense. They were polytheistic. That comes out a lot. But, you know, Heidegger's so also indebted to Hölderlin or other thinkers. And the Christian overtones are immediate. If you know to look.
And I mean, I would add to this that there's a sense in which Heidegger invites the Christian theologians, Catholics, Protestants, and others were and are still attracted to Heidegger's thinking because they identify so much of their own tradition in his thought. And there's a sense in which he's constantly re-Christianized, as it were, and adopted into Christian theology or back into Christian theology, depends on, you know, how you approach him. And there's a sense in which he invites it. He does invoke these terms that have Christian roots to them. And I read somewhere, someone put it very nicely. Someone said that Heidegger offers a theological itch, but does not allow us to scratch it. Something like that. And he definitely does that, right? So in Being in Time, where he offers this existential analytic of Dasein, he offers these categories that have strong theological resonances. He speaks of Schuld, of guilt. He speaks of fallenness, and stuff like that. And later on, he'll speak of the gods and of the holy. Throughout the 20th century, there were a lot of readers of Heidegger who said, well, yeah, he has this, right? Adorno says he has a theological aura to his philosophy. And Karl Lovit says that one of the reasons that Heidegger was so attractive to so many of his generation was that he offered this godless theology where, you know, you could carry on thinking about sacredness and experiencing the world as a site of holiness without having the traditional Christian strings attached. And this entire complicated relationship with Christianity, where he clearly rejects it and criticizes it, but also demonstrates some kind of debt to it, is a very is part of the Jewish reception of his thought, because they don't only, these Jewish thinkers that I deal with in the book, don't only focus on his philosophy, but in their reading of his philosophy, also constantly are aware of what they see as, remnants of Christian layers to it. So through their engagement with his philosophy, they're reading him, but they're also engaging with Christianity.
So now moving into the more Jewish reception part of the book that's opened up in your first chapter, I want to ask about, so your first chapter, or not your first chapter, I think the second chapter is on early Christian or early Jewish reception to Zeit und Zeit and Martin Heidegger's works and how it creates this Christian anthropology. Can you elaborate on how Heidegger or how the Jewish thinkers received this and how they're outlining the Christian overtones or the Christianity within his anthropology, and how does Judaism interact with this and come into play, and where they're, how are these critiques related to it, to a Jewishness of the thinker?
Yeah. Well, I think the best way to answer that question is maybe to offer a brief historical background of what was going on at the time. I think that could be a good segue to understand why these thinkers are reading Heidegger the way they are, and what in his thought was, you know, bothering them, in a sense. So in the chapter that you're referring to, I focus on some of the early Jewish readings of Being in Time. So we're talking about late 1920s, 1930s approaches to Heidegger's Being in Time. And during this time, so we're talking about interwar period in Germany, this period stages what can be termed some kind of generational clash between two different approaches, two different frameworks of thinking, of religion, of philosophy, of culture, of politics, where the generation of the time, the younger generation was seeking to distance itself from the previous generation, and even rebel and try to reimagine and reformulate what it means to be Jewish. So if the previous generation was mainly neo-Kantian, or rather neo-Kantianism was the reigning philosophical framework, it upheld rationalism, and there was this synthesis between Kantianism and Judaism. So this new generation tried to rethink what Jewishness is. So the great figure of the previous generation was Hermann Cohen, who offered this really impressive synthesis between what Judaism stands for, the ideas, the ideals of Judaism. And he was, very strongly informed by Kant, Kant's rationalism, Kant's ethics. And this was perceived by this new generation as selling out Judaism, as formulating it in foreign frameworks or templates. And what they tried to do was rejuvenate Judaism by rethinking it along more existential, experiential lines. So there was this anti-liberal sentiment to this generation, and they were looking for how could I think about Judaism not as a set of detached ideas, but rather as something that concerns me, as something that demands of me something in my historical, actual, concrete existence. This was part of a general rethinking of the generation. And Heidegger was part of this generational rebellion as well. And this basically meant that Heidegger would be often a person that Jewish thinkers would look at in order to try to formulate what a Jewish existence would look like from a philosophical point of view. I'll rephrase that if possible. One of the main things that Jewish thinkers in this generation wanted to do was offer an authentic version of what Judaism and Jewishness means. And they saw the previous generation's answer to be inauthentic. They found it too Christian, too liberal, too middle class, too detached of their concrete, actual historical existence. And they wanted to formulate a version of Jewishness that was not detached, that was, addressed their actual existence. And this was, a parallel dynamic was taking place in Christian theology at the time, and, in just general philosophy. And Heidegger was part of this. Heidegger was a main spokesperson of this strand of thinking, of we're not looking for detached philosophical systems. We're looking for concrete existential answers to the questions of human existence. So Heidegger's philosophy presented itself as a possible address for Jewish thinkers to consult and use in order to formulate a authentic account of Jewish existence. And many indeed turned to Heidegger. The problem with Heidegger, they quickly found, was that it was unclear to them whether his philosophy really could offer them what they wanted. And what they wanted was an analysis of human existence that they felt can apply to Jewish existence, to the particularity of Jewish existence. And that's what Heidegger, you know, at least presented himself as offering. He said, I'm offering an ontological account of Dasein, and it gives itself to whatever ontic instance. But when these Jewish thinkers opened Being and Time and read what Heidegger wrote there, they felt that they constantly ran up against these ideas, not only terminology, but also content that sounded very Christian to them. Either in terms, you know, just speaking of, you know, Heidegger speaks, as I mentioned, of this guilt or this debt that Dasein always has, you know, regardless of any concrete action, Dasein comes into the world, as it were, indebted, or the idea that Dasein's existence is towards death, which Jewish thinkers and Christian thinkers as well, they said, well, we're familiar with this idea and with this terminology. We're familiar with this from Kierkegaard, from Luther, from the New Testament. These ideas that Heidegger is offering, these so, you know, supposedly neutral analysis of human existence actually sounds like it is informed by a certain religious tradition that is not neutral, right? And then these thinkers had to ask themselves, how do we approach these seemingly Christian layers in Heidegger's philosophy? Now, no one would say, they all agree that Heidegger was offering a secular account. But as I show in this in chapter 3 of my book, the question of secularization emerged as very important for the Jewish reception of Heidegger, because they would agree that what Heidegger was offering was a secular or secularized understanding of human existence. But the question is, how exactly should we understand this process of secularization? Should we understand it as simply a reduction of whatever past theological layers were there, and therefore perhaps the origin of these ideas and this content can find, you know, the origin is in Christian tradition, but in its manifestation in Heidegger, in its application in Heidegger's analysis of Dasein, these layers no longer play any role, and it's simply a secular account. And for them, that would be enough for it to be able to be reappropriated and used for Jewish existence. Or should we understand secularization as a process in which the theological charge of these terms is negated, but still something is, you know, something remains. Something remains of its Christian past, and therefore, even in Heidegger's philosophical analysis of Dasein, what he's offering is not simply a secular account, but a secularized account. That is, an account of human existence that is in some way still colored by its Christian past. And for many Jewish thinkers, that meant that insofar as Heidegger's philosophy is conditioned by Christianity, it cannot really be used appropriately to offer an understanding of Jewish existence. And what I show in this chapter is basically a long list of thinkers who targeted and mentioned these examples of Christian-sounding terms or ideas that sound like they, you know, that they are rooted in Christian tradition. And say, wait a second, this Heidegger's analysis of death, Heidegger's analysis of Dasein's fallenness, these all sound these are all actually Christian notions, secularized Christian notions, and therefore it simply won't do for someone who's trying to offer an authentic Jewish account.
That was a great answer. And it brings me to a question that I want to skip a chapter and or maybe two, I don't know. And go to a question of Strauss and Leo Strauss. So you're talking about Leo Strauss and how, and I'll let you maybe give a little introduction to him and his thinking, and perhaps his relationship to Heidegger and also Schmitt, who I think is an important interlocutor for the two and how they would relate. But how Strauss is doing something that might be different than what other Jewish philosophers are doing with Heidegger, in the sense that, you know, in that third chapter, there's an idea that, you know, Heidegger, we came to Heidegger looking for something and we didn't find it. But Strauss notes that, you know, maybe the way out, even though he represents a danger, he also gives us a way out of the danger. You write that he offers the theoretical breakthrough that directs us out of crisis. So I'm wondering if you can talk about how Strauss formulated this and maybe what, how Heidegger himself is, can be both the danger and the way out, almost like a pharmacon, the poison as well as the cure.
Yes. So Leo Strauss was a well-known and important political philosopher, theorist, who was born in Germany, studied with Heidegger. He wasn't in the close circle of Heidegger's students, but he studied with Heidegger and was, well, one of those of Heidegger's students who were completely taken by Heidegger, and who, in a sense, their entire intellectual career afterwards is, in one way or another, a constant grappling with this encounter, with their encounter with Heidegger's, with the person and his philosophy. Strauss, like a number of Heidegger's other students, was completely shattered by Heidegger in 1933, where Heidegger joined the Nazi Party, and tried to rethink his approach to Heidegger in light of the fact that he believed that Heidegger's philosophy and politics were closely intertwined. So Strauss has this great quote where he says something along the lines of, only a great thinker or only a great philosopher could help us in our present predicament. But the only problem is that the only great thinker we have is Heidegger. And Heidegger, for Strauss, represented the great crisis of thought. So that was the bind that Strauss identified in the contemporary moment in modern philosophy as a whole. That modern philosophy needs a great thinker, but the problem is the only great thinker, one of the only great thinkers modern philosophy has to offer, is the most problematic one, is the one who embodies the great crises of the time, which he saw as historicism and nihilism. Now, Strauss's project, you know, in a nutshell, was an attempt to revive his understanding of political philosophy, which was basically to be able to approach or rethink or ask the question again, the question of the great life, the question of how one, what is the good, how should we live? And this, Strauss believed, cannot be asked anymore in the context of modern philosophy, because modern philosophy believes that it has answered conclusively all the important questions of philosophy, and therefore could progress. It could move on to answer different questions. This, he believed, was connected to the historicist framework, the idea that that specific truths are relevant to specific historical backgrounds and periods, and that there isn't some kind of enduring natural truth that would correlate to eternal questions that are constantly asked and constantly stay open. And Strauss wanted to step outside or overcome what he believed was this crisis of thought. And he also believed that insofar as we have this historicist mind frame, we can't reach truth. Truth is relativized, and therefore you can't really establish a stable ethics because you don't have you don't have resort to a foundation to truth, actually. And therefore he has this rather immediate connection between historicism, relativism, and nihilism. And that works very well with him in his analysis of Heidegger. He reads Heidegger as this radical historicist. That is, he claims that Heidegger believes that being reveals itself differently in different epochs, in different times, and therefore there is no eternal truth. There is only historicized revelations of being. And therefore, Heidegger relativizes truth. Heidegger is a nihilist. He doesn't really actually believe his truth is relativized to historical periods. And the fact that Heidegger joined the Nazi Party demonstrates the fact that he's a nihilist. But instead of simply, rejecting Heidegger and just saying he is a nihilist, he is the worst thinker that we could possibly engage with and just do away with him, Strauss actually found in Heidegger a philosophical framework that can gesture or signal towards the possibility of overcoming it. So Strauss has this image that he offers in a bunch of different places, where it says, the Platonic cave is the state of philosophy, right? Philosophy tries to transition from opinion to knowledge. And that's a very difficult thing. Philosophy is difficult. But modern philosophy makes this difficult task even more difficult because of historicism. It basically doesn't allow itself to move from opinion to knowledge because it doesn't accept the possibility of knowledge, which Strauss understands as, enduring truths. And therefore, modern philosophy is the second cave under the first cave of Plato. So only to begin or to begin anew the taxing job of philosophy, we have to climb out of the second cave and into the first cave. Now, for Strauss, Heidegger was the quintessential, thinker who, carved the second cave because he was this radical historicist. But he also believed that Heidegger could offer, as it were, the ladder from the second cave into the first cave. And the reason for that is that Heidegger offered a critique of modern, of metaphysics as a whole. And Heidegger believed that a new approach, a more attuned approach to being can be achieved if we in some way reapproach Greek thought and identify in Greek thought and pre-Socratic thought a pristine moment of thinking before the emergence of metaphysics and engaging with this, critically engaging with this moment of thought could offer a constructive resource for thinking forward and overcoming metaphysics in this way. And Strauss did not necessarily want to do the same thing in the same manner that Heidegger did, but Strauss identified in the possibility that Heidegger offered to return to the Greeks, to go back and try to rethink through resources of the past and through the tradition of philosophy. Strauss found that to be a very constructive way of going forward as well. So there's a sense in which Strauss parallels Heidegger in his critique of modern philosophy, that this cannot go on further. We have to rethink philosophy. He parallels Heidegger in the sense that he thinks that returning is in some sense a way forward. And he also identifies Greek philosophy, ancient Greece, as a possible way, a possible resource for thinking. But unlike Heidegger, Strauss believes that it's Athens and Jerusalem that are in this constant confrontation. So there's two different ways of answering the great question, the great philosophical question, the great question of political philosophy of what is the great life. There's Athens, which he believes represented in Greek philosophy and philosophy, which is unaided reason and thinking philosophically, and Jerusalem, which for Strauss represents revelation and Jewish monotheism, and reviving this confrontation was what Strauss thought philosophy needed most. So, you know, this is a long way of answering your question. Why is Heidegger both so problematic and also potentially the person, the philosopher who signals towards overcoming the philosophical dead end that he himself represents, is the idea that traditional philosophy, that approaching in a new way, the tradition of philosophy can offer a way out of the contemporary crisis.
Yeah, that was another great response. I think it calls back to Heidegger's theorization, or his theory, or his praxis of destruction, which people might be familiar with in Derridian deconstruction. That's how deconstruction is how Derrida translates it. And it's this, Heidegger talks about he uses almost an archaeological metaphor, and says all these layers of sediment have built up over the history of philosophy, and we must brush them away. We must destroy them. We must destruct them and get back to something so we can build from there again. And you really talk about how Strauss is doing that move to Heidegger. He's going back to the original of the original. And I'm glad you brought up Athens and Jerusalem, because it brings me to my next question, which is about Buber. And I want to also bring this towards Levinas, so have that in mind. But you talk about how Buber, Martin Buber, who wrote I Thou, Ich Du, stages a confrontation with Heidegger in the sense that he wants to talk about dialogue and about how we're always with the other, and we're always in communication with thou, the ultimate thou of God, but also the thous of other people. And he stages this as a conversation or a dialogue between what you identify as generally Greek monological philosophy and a Jewish dialogical alternative. So I want to ask about how Buber is thinking about dialogue, and how that kind of upsets the ipseity or the selfness or the solipsism of Heidegger, as well as what it means to what you call dwell prophetically in relation to Heidegger's dwelling poetically.
Yeah. So throughout the book, I show that this paradigm of Athens and Jerusalem is a thread that runs in a lot of these Jewish engagements with Heidegger, not only Strauss. So Strauss is, trademarked this idea of Athens and Jerusalem, but it's a general, it's a formal paradigm. So basically anyone could insert whatever content they want into what Greek is and what, Jewish is, or what Athens is, what Jerusalem is, whether or not Jerusalem includes Judaism and Christianity, or only Judaism. Is Christianity Athens? Is it, somewhere in the middle? So that's part of the engagement with Heidegger, is implicitly also offering a construction of Athens and Jerusalem vis-a-vis philosophy and secularism, and vis-a-vis Christianity, and where Judaism, as these thinkers understand it, is to be positioned. And Strauss wants to offer he wants to revive this confrontation between Athens and Jerusalem. And for him, the two are you can't reduce one to the other. They are separated and detached, and they could challenge each other, but they're really in a confrontation. Strauss saw himself, I think it's fair to say, as a citizen of Athens, as it were, but he saw that Jerusalem constitutes a constant challenge and threat to the Athens way of thinking, as it were. And that's where thought, that's the fuel for philosophy, constantly having to deal with the challenge of Jerusalem. Buber has a different understanding of this Athens and Jerusalem. Buber perceives himself as channeling this Jewish insight, or rather an insight that he finds has been articulated in Jewish history in its most pristine or best form. And it's what he called the dialogical principle. And Buber's version of Jewish history, so for him, Jesus is an important milestone in Jewish history, a manifestation, a really an embodiment of this dialogical principle. And Buber follows a long line of Jewish thinkers who appropriate Jesus as a model Jew. And this is part of his reading of Jewish history and of his the dialogical impulse animating it. And for Buber, the idea is that what is most meaningful happens in between. Encounters our existence in the world is an interaction. It's an encounter with things that are not us. And we could only truly become ourselves when and through the encounter with another. So this encounter with another could be with God, could be with fellow human beings. It could be with objects in the world. And he perceives himself, he offers a dialogical philosophy in the sense that we are constantly in an engagement and encountering other people, other things in the world, and that is how authenticity that's how authenticity emerges. And this idea of dialogical existence, Buber felt, was under threat in modernity because of a lot of different reasons: technology, the rise of science, the general alienation of modern culture. And what Buber wanted to do was to revive this idea of encounter, of in between, of I and thou, of dialogue. And he felt that Heidegger's philosophy was channeling a long tradition. He also had different terms for it, of a tradition that celebrated or espoused monologue. He called it Gnosticism. Basically, a tradition of thought that was closed off to the other person, that perceived human existence as one that was closed off to fellow humans and to God. And for Buber, those two are intimately connected. And in his engagement with Heidegger, what he tried to do, he constantly offered his dialogical philosophy as an alternative to what he saw as Heidegger's monological philosophy. So this is a constant critique throughout the 20th century. There's this idea that the account of human existence that Heidegger offers, penetrating and original as it may be, ultimately only offers a solipsistic analysis of human existence. In other words, Heidegger does not offer an account of intersubjectivity. Dasein, the Dasein that he portrays in the pages of Being and Time, is one who is enclosed in its own existence and can't really account for the existence of another person. Now, this is something that, this is a critique that from the very beginning, so Karl Lovit wrote his Habilitation in 1928, okay, so a year after Being in Time was published, where Lovit tries to develop this idea of mit einander sein, so being with another, as some kind of corrective to Heidegger's idea of mitsein, this idea that we are always already with other people and our world is always a shared world and always determined by the existence of other people. But this critique of Heidegger's solipsism, or his monologism, or his inability to account for the other person or for intersubjectivity, is one that, I mean, Buber says Gogarden, Scheler, Lovit, Hannah Arendt has a version of this. Levinas's philosophy, you know, if we want to really reduce it to this one idea, is basically that Heidegger cannot account for otherness. So it's a version of this critique that Heidegger cannot account for intersubjectivity for the other person. And again, there's an ethical layer to this, that his endorsement of Nazism reflects the fact that Heidegger cannot establish, Heidegger's philosophy, and also Heidegger the person, the philosopher, cannot establish a robust ethics. So what Buber constantly does is read Heidegger as offering a philosophy of monologue, a philosophy of a human being who is closed up onto itself and cannot encounter, cannot really meet other people and cannot really meet God. And the result is an impoverished and, Buber would also believe, dangerous philosophy. And what he tries to do is offer his philosophy as an alternative to Heidegger's, and say, well, Heidegger says this, and what I will draw on the same exact sources, and that could be Hölderlin's poetry, that could be Heraclitus, or that could be, you know, the same German philosophers who Heidegger engages with, and offer a different analysis that would present a philosophy that champions, that celebrates encounter and meeting and engagements, and it could actually account for a human existence that that is more true to the world as we live it, right? And Buber believes that he's channeling, that this is Jewish thought, this is prophetic thinking. The prophets are the exemplar for Buber of dialogical existence. And basically, in the way I read Buber's critical engagement with Heidegger is that he poses as an alternative to Heidegger's idea of poetic existence, of existing in the world in a, through poesis, as a in a poetic manner that is attuned to being and allowing being to be and just being open to how being reveals itself to us, rather than trying to impose ourselves and to coerce being to be what we want it to be. And in that way, to discover the world as a site of holiness and of sacredness. And Heidegger calls this the return of the gods. And Buber would share that impulse. Buber would say, yes, we need to recover and reattune ourselves to the world in a way that will allow us to reveal its sacredness and its holiness. But that cannot be done through Heidegger's philosophy. That could only be done through my philosophy, which takes as its source and as its cue, Jewish tradition, this dialogical principle that Buber finds in the biblical Hebrew prophets.
So you bring up something, I mean, you're bringing up a lot of really interesting points. And I think something that I want to get to is a discussion of Levinas in a certain way. And so Levinas, you quote him at the beginning of the book saying that Heidegger is maybe the most important thinker or philosopher of certainly the century, maybe of the millennia. And I think that's something that we've been grappling with this whole conversation throughout your whole book, I think also as like a philosophical community of readers. But Levinas does something radically different, and I'd love to hear you talk more about it, in the sense that what he's doing is he's putting ethics first. He's putting ethics as our before ontology, and that's very obviously a critique of Heidegger. And I'm wondering, just can you talk about how Levinas is critiquing Heidegger at the same time he can think of him as, you know, the great philosopher, and how this is related to a Jewish reception specifically?
Yes. So Levinas, as you said, it's actually pretty remarkable to read one philosopher, to read what Levinas writes about Heidegger. I mean, it's rare to read a philosopher speak so highly of another philosopher. It just Levinas, when he talks about Heidegger, Heidegger is a genius, the most brilliant philosophy, you know, the Mont Blanc of philosophy, this once in a millennia. And at the same time, Levinas sees Heidegger's philosophy to be philosophy of Hitlerism, as the title of an essay Levinas writes in 1930s, and as fundamentally immoral, totalitarian in its essence. And this is part of why reading Levinas is fascinating and difficult. And it's also why Levinas, like Strauss, like others, was grappling with Heidegger throughout his entire life. So Levinas as well was a Jewish student of Heidegger, and he too formulated his philosophy with Heidegger, through Heidegger, and against Heidegger. His main critique was that Heidegger's philosophy is basically fixated on being. It's focused on ontology. And in Levinas' understanding, everything else in Heidegger's world derives from the approach to being. And when philosophy takes that move, the approach to the other person, to the concrete, actual other person, will always go through being. So the philosophy through that, in this prism, cannot really engage with the other person, because it's ultimately focused on this abstract category of being. And again, Heidegger's Nazism plays into this. And what Levinas tries to offer is an understanding of philosophy, or an account of philosophy, that doesn't put ontology first, doesn't first look to being and then approach everything through the category of being, but begin from what he calls ethics, that is the responsibility towards the concrete other, and build from that, begin from ethics, responsibility, the call of the other, and carry on doing philosophy from that starting point, and basically condition philosophy with ethics. And Levinas claims to be transmitting this Jewish insight, a Jewish idea. He at some point claims that what his philosophy is a translation of Jewish knowledge into Greek thought. When one reads his philosophical works in parallel to his more straightforward Jewish works, his Talmudic writings, his essays on Jewish subjects, it's obvious that he's conveying the same ideas in both registers. And what Levinas claims to be doing is offering a Jewish corrective to Heidegger's ontological fixation. And Levinas would actually say Heidegger is a representative of Western philosophy as a whole. This ontological fixation and this the constant ignoring of otherness is a feature, a constant feature, an essential feature of philosophy from the very beginning. The idea that anything that is different, anything that is other, has to be co-opted, has to be appropriated into what he calls the same, into the knowable, into the familiar, into what we are able to identify, that is a feature of Western thought, Levinas will say. And the idea of allowing otherness to remain in its otherness, not quickly trying to devour it and reduce its otherness into sameness, is something that Levinas claims to find in Jewish tradition and tries to, he says, translate. I'm a bit critical of this metaphor of translation with Levinas, but he tries to offer it to Western thought as a contribution as a corrective to what he considers its totalitarian impulse, this idea that, you know, we're seeking for a totality. And anything new, anything other, we are going to subsume into the totality that we already acknowledge and we already recognize.
Yeah, I think Levinas' ethics are something that, I don't know, I wish everybody was reading. And it feels especially pertinent to the moment, to now, to contemporaneity. And I think you can't forget Heidegger in the Levinas, or his critique of him.
Yeah, what I try to do in my analysis of Levinas, and I'm really not the first one to point this out, is that Levinas's approach to Heidegger is really, he constantly presents it as this, radical opposition, as this dichotomy between Heidegger and his own thought, between otherness and sameness, between the totalitarian impulse of Western philosophy and Levinas's philosophy of ethics and otherness. And what I try to show is that beyond the rhetoric of, dichotomous opposition, when you approach it with, put a little more critical pressure on it, as it were, it becomes immediately clear that Levinas is clearly dependent on Heidegger's philosophy. And not only that, but also that there is a sense in which he needs Heidegger's philosophy to remain as it is, to stay as it is, for his own philosophy to then disturb it as its otherness. So it's not a dichotomy between Levinas and Heidegger, as Levinas likes to depict it, but rather much more of a dialectic, whereby Levinas tries to, overcome, problematize Heidegger by being dependent on Heidegger, by establishing himself on Heidegger, and by always needing to constantly overcome and reestablish and overcome and reestablish Heidegger in order for Levinas's philosophy to remain the disruption that it wishes to be.
So I have one final question, which is, what are you thinking about now? What's next? Do you have anything already in the pipeline, or what questions are you sitting with at the moment?
Yeah, so Heidegger is quicksand in the sense that it's never ending, and you could really be consumed by his thought and by its terminology and by his vast reception. So there's really a lot more that could be said about Heidegger's Jewish reception, let alone his general reception, which is obviously ongoing. And I still have a few other projects, Heidegger related, in the pipeline, but I'm looking forward to, putting Heidegger on hold for a while. And what I'm thinking about right now is trying to develop some of the thoughts that I had while writing the earlier chapters of this Heidegger book on existenz philosophie, on this idea, this philosophical turn towards existence and what its theological underpinnings might be. and see how this existential turn in the beginning of the 20th century draws on various revolutions or various intellectual dynamics that took place earlier in the 19th century vis-a-vis Martin Luther. So 19th century German Protestant theology, there was this robust return to Luther after Kant as this attempt to rethink Protestant theology and complete the Reformation. And Kant opened the door to finally doing this. And this return to Luther allowed a refocus on the existential condition of the believer, of the subject. And I want to look into how this return to Luther played itself out in Protestant thought and in Jewish thought, and what stories Protestant thinkers and Jewish thinkers tell themselves as to what it is they're doing in reappropriating Luther in this modern post-Kantian guise. So that's the general gist of where my thoughts are right now.
Well, that sounds like just an incredibly interesting project. And, you know, if it turns into anything, I would love to have you back on the show and talk more.
I'd love to be back.
And, you know, leave Heidegger for a moment and think about something else.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to say thank you for being on the show, for talking with us. I'm sure people will get a lot out of this episode.
Thank you. Thank you. It was great to be on the show.
So once again, this was Danielle Herskowitz. I got it right that time, talking about his book, Heidegger and His Jewish Reception, which was published by Cambridge University Press. I'm your host, Britt Edelin, for the New Books Network. Thank you, as always, and until next time.